volunteers will come into our training. Ray and I both teach one called audio production, which is one of the first trainings. You come in, you learn how to run a production studio, how to use the mic, how to record off a CD, a cassette even, how to use the phones if you're doing phone interviews. And people come in with incredible passion, and they come in from all sorts of different points of views and background, and that's the kind of diversity that you're supporting when you become a member of KBOO. That's truly community radio, and you don't see that much across the U.S. anymore.
And Ken, I want to take this opportunity to thank Kathleen for renewing and thank Monica for renewing, both from Portland.
Oh, thank you, Kathleen. Thank you, Monica.
And as we get ready to go into Radio Zine, let me take this last opportunity to remind you what that number is. Give us a call, 877-500-5266. Again, that number is 877-500-5266. Or go online to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you, Ray. And now we're going to hear a bit about some of our other friends in the community who are supporting KBOO in their way. And we're going to follow that with the Radio Zine presenting Assignment Memphis, The Plot That Killed the Dream. We'll hear all about that in just a moment, so stay tuned.
KBOO would like to give special thanks to our local community partners who have donated food for our volunteers today. Breakfast was provided by Daily Cafe, located at 902 Northwest 13th Avenue. Daily Cafe serves breakfast, lunch, wine, and spirits daily. Lunch was provided by Bokeh Bowl, with two locations, 1028 Southeast Water Avenue and 1200 Northwest 18th at Northrop. Bokeh Bowl serve ramen with homemade noodles and more. Dinner was provided by Canaan's Barbecue Rib Express, located at 5410 Northeast 33rd Avenue, an award-winning genuine hickory smoked barbecue with their own special sauce. For more information on how you can support KBOO, call 877-500-5266 right now.
Tune in to KBOO on Saturday, April 21st from 5:30 to midnight to hear a live broadcast of the 7th Annual Inner City Blues Festival. The evening starts off with Steve Chesboro and a country blues set at 5:30 p.m. Later performers include the I&I Band Reunion, King Louis Payne Quartet featuring LaRonda Steele, the Norman Sylvester Review, the Maddest Held Doctors and Nurses, and more. Again, that's the Inner City Blues Festival on Saturday, April 21st, from 5:30 to midnight at the North Portland Eagles Lodge and live on your favorite community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Police have issued an all-points bulletin for a well-dressed young white man seen running from the scene.
Throughout the past 50 years, researchers have been digging into the official story that the well-dressed young white man, James Earl Ray, shot Dr. King from the bathroom window of a rooming house opposite the Lorraine Motel. And under scrutiny, the case against Ray looks quite different. For instance, the state's chief witness, Charles Stevens, who identified Ray running out of the rooming house after firing the shot was...
He was in no condition to identify anyone.
His partner, Grace Walden.
The way he was laying on the bed, sleeping one off.
And it seemed to me the shot didn't come from the bathroom in the first place, but somewhere out back of the building.
Shelby County Criminal Court Judge Joseph Brown, who presided over 2 years of hearings on Ray's rifle the state claimed as the murder weapon, said,
"The bullet they pull out of King's body has a rate of rifling twist of one turn in every 11 and a quarter inches. The rifle that Ray had a rate of rifling twist of one turn in every 10 inches and a bad manufacturing defect that is not apparent on the death slug."
When I went into the streets of Memphis and Shelby County,
author and international civil rights attorney Dr. William Pepper,
and began to talk to people and began to look at evidence and began to consider issues with people who were there and on the scene, the inconsistencies that I found the unanswered questions that I found, the unaccepted evidence that came forward, evidence that had been rejected, had a cumulative effect on me. And I knew, increasingly knew, that we were staring injustice in the face.
For most of the years since his escape from prison, evidence shows Ray to have been a highly paid errand boy for an underworld figure he had fallen in with named Raul. Ray was eager to leave the country, except he had no passport, but Raul kept telling him,
"Do me just a few more favors and I get you a passport and tickets to anywhere you want to go."
Ray claimed he was never told anything beyond the petty tasks he was asked to carry out. The day before the assassination, Raul told him to buy a Remington rifle and bring it to him. Then, an hour before the murder, he told him to disappear and come back later. So Ray ran an errand in the white Mustang Raul bought for him. Not until after the murder, listening to the radio, did he realize the plot he'd fallen into. And worse, that the man they were looking for...
Police describe a young, well-dressed, medium-built white male driving a white Mustang, shot at and wounded, possibly critically wounded, Dr. Martin Luther King...
was him.
James Earl Ray was blocks away from the Lorraine at the time of the shooting.
William Pepper.
And a minimum of three witnesses would have corroborated this had they been called to testify. At that point, the prosecution's case would have collapsed, as the state would have had no reliable evidence placing Ray at the scene or connecting his rifle to the death slug.
And yet, says Pepper,
this was evidence that was never put into either a hearing or a trial in any court.
The reason being, Ray never went to trial. Instead, he entered a guilty plea and was marched off to life in prison. Why, if the case against him were that weak? That answer lies 2 months further on, in June of 68. After 2 months on the run, Ray is apprehended in London's Heathrow Airport. Awaiting extradition, he hires attorneys Arthur Haynes and Son to represent him. In Memphis, an entire cell block had been prepared for Ray. Retired Circuit Court Judge Arthur Haynes, Jr.
They had built a barred cage, a cell within a cell, on an abandoned floor of the Shelby County Jail.
He is kept under glaring lights 24 hours a day. Closed-circuit cameras monitor his movements. Guards are with him in his cell around the clock, while others watch him outside his cell. Microphones pick up every sound. Even his breathing is heard. He has no fresh air, no air conditioning, no daylight. He knows not is it day or night.
We filed a motion to turn off the lights and give him some privacy.
The motion stating the television lights, cameras, and microphones that constantly surveil the defendant constitute an electric form of cruel and unusual punishment. They allow him neither rest nor sleep, rendering him nervous and disturbed.
That motion didn't work. He had no breaks going his way, or whatever, in the case, except for the fact that ultimately we were going to win it.
After 114 days in these conditions, Houston attorney Percy Foreman arrives and, in a highly irregular move, is allowed to speak with Ray. He tells him,
"I know the Haynes team well, and all they are interested in is money. If you stick with them, you will wind up in the electric chair. There is no better trial lawyer in the country than me. Of the 1,500 death penalty cases I've handled, fewer than half went to trial, and almost no one went to jail. And your case is the easiest one I've ever seen."
We were completely confident we were going to win the case because the state was bound to the theory that one man, James Earl Ray, acting alone, killed Dr. King. The evidence belied that theory. It simply would not work and could not be proven.
After firing his shot, the state alleged Ray rushed out of the building with his rifle wrapped in a blanket, intending to toss it into his car and drive off. But seeing a police car, he panicked and ditched his bundle in front of the Knipe Amusement Company next door and then fled the scene.
There were many reasons we were convinced the verdict would be not guilty. One of which was Mr. Knipes, who was the owner of the amusement shop where the package was thrown down, was going to testify that the package was thrown down 5 or 10 minutes before the shot was fired. We went back to Memphis on Sunday night to take him some trial clothes and do some final preparations. We were handed a note Ray had written saying, "Thank you for all you've done, but I've decided to change lawyers." Unbeknownst to me, after I left the jail on Friday, Percy Foreman spent the night with Ray convincing him to change lawyers.
Soon after, Foreman met with the prosecutors and the judge, and they agreed to a sentence of 99 years in exchange for a guilty plea. Thereafter, Foreman begins telling Ray,
"A trial's not in your best interest. The prosecution is bribing witnesses and stacking the jury against you. Chamber of Commerce is pressuring the judge for a speedy trial and a guilty verdict because the publicity has proven bad for business. And with the wave of pretrial publicity, you are already guilty as hell in the public's mind."
Ray held out for a trial, insisting he never knew he was involved in an assassination, and he certainly did not shoot anyone. Foreman turned up the pressure.
"If we go to trial, I am convinced you will be convicted, and nearly certain you will receive the death penalty. But if you plead guilty, I can at least get you a jail term."
Still, Ray refused. At the 11th hour, Foreman sends Ray a letter telling him,
"My health has taken a turn for the worse, and I don't have the strength to mount a full trial. Your best option is to plead guilty, accept a life sentence, then recant the plea, request a trial, and use the enclosed $500 for a new lawyer. And if you say nothing to embarrass me in court, I will see to it you're paroled in 2 or 3 years.
With Ray still hesitating, he tells him,
"If you force me to go to trial, I will deliberately destroy the case in the courtroom."
By Thursday of that same week, we were getting calls and letters from Ray saying, "Boys, I've made the biggest mistake of my life. Please come back and try this case for me. All this guy wants me to do is plead guilty."
Ray petitions the court to discharge Foreman and rehire the Haynes team and is denied.
"He couldn't sleep. Those bright lights on all the time,"
said James' brother, Jerry Ray.
"Always being looked at. No fresh air, never any daylight, never any night. It was like a concentration camp where you end up doing things you wouldn't ordinarily do. James was sort of out of his mind at the time. He hadn't seen the outside even through a window in 4 months.
March 10th, 1969, Foreman enters a guilty plea for Ray, and he is sentenced to life in prison. 3 days later, he petitions for a post-conviction hearing to recant his plea and request a trial, and is denied.
As KBOO listeners know, it's 50 years since the assassination of Martin Luther King, and we've been paying particular attention to it this month during its sad anniversary. You're listening to a dramatization of the investigation and the resultant trial and then questions of the result of the trial on Radio Zine. This is not the first time we've looked at it. Our own Per Fagerin interviewed William Pepper live on this very radio station just a few weeks ago. These are really good examples of why it's important for you to be kept up to date by your community radio station, KBOO. We're here, we're presenting all sides of the story. We're not commercial, we don't have a bias, we're just trying to get the truth out to you. And we need your support, so please give us a call at 877-500-5266 or go online to kboo.fm.
Ray, it's a good example of the mix of programming we have here. Here's the same subject matter, but we had a local perspective from Pear when he interviewed William Pepper. We ran that previously. And then today, a more nationally syndicated perspective. Again, as you mentioned, a dramatization on the investigation into the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King, the assassination, which occurred 50 years ago last month in March. And that's the kind of programming you'll get as part of our public affairs menu here on KBOO Portland, your community radio station. Again, 80% of our operating budget is from you, the listener. By becoming a member, you're supporting programs like this. You're supporting our music shows, our arts and culture shows, our news shows, our shows from local activists, from people of color, from the LGBTQ community. This is stuff that shows the diversity of the community, and you won't find this on the mainstream media here. You're not going to find it certainly on K2 Channel 2, which is owned by Sinclair, and they're very conscripted in terms of what they can tell you in terms of their news. You won't find that here. This is an independent media voice, and you can support that voice by calling up 877-500-5266 to become a member or going online at kboo.fm. And Ray, it's our 50th anniversary. KBOO started back in 1968, and we have a special anniversary package for listeners.
Ken, it is. It's a very nice package. It's the KBOO 50th anniversary special CD, booklet, and enamel lapel pin. And that can be yours for a contributing membership of $10 a month, which is only $120 a year. And if you were to make that call today, there are only a limited number of these packages, these booklet packages.
We only have 20.
We only have 20. They won't last long. They are collector's items, and they are great documentation of the first 50 years of your community radio station, KBOO. So I'd ask you to take this opportunity. Give us a call, 877-500-5266, or go to kboo.fm and click on donate.
We invited Foreman to have our file. He came to Birmingham, showed absolutely no interest in seeing what we had or hearing what we had to say or talking about it. He was offered a complete trial file with a ready case, and he had absolutely no interest whatsoever in looking at it or seeing it. As far as we could tell, he never intended to give Ray a trial or in any way prepare the case. There was no doubt in our mind that Ray was browbeaten into making a confession.
The essential case against James Earl Ray was so flawed, it would have been difficult for the jury to have returned a guilty verdict,
said civil rights attorney Mark Lane, who took up Ray's case. So did attorney Jack Kershaw. William Pepper pursued Ray's case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and at every turn, his petition for trial or review was denied. Determined to air the facts of the case in formal judicial proceedings, William Pepper set up a courtroom in 93 and conducted a criminal trial of his own, adhering to the Tennessee laws of criminal procedure and recorded for television. Witnesses testified under oath and were cross-examined before an independent jury. Reverend James Orange, Dr. King's Memphis coordinator, told the court, "From that day to this, I have never had any doubt that the fatal shot was fired by a sniper concealed in the brush. But when I tried to tell police what I saw, they told me to keep quiet and stay out of the way." Reverend Orange said later,
"And then I turn around and look back over my right shoulder, looking around to see, and I saw like a puff of smoke right behind the fire station where they had all of those bushes. To this day, I haven't been talked to by the Justice Department, by the Memphis Police Department, no one about what I saw the day of the assassination. And I think some of the stuff was covered up, to be honest. I don't want to point fingers at people who was there, but why were some people talked to who wasn't within 50 yards of him, and I was like 5-10 feet away from him and wasn't talked to?"
The jury heard that Dr. King's lodgings were changed from the Claridge, where he stayed in the past, to the Lorraine, and that the night before his arrival, someone called to change his Lorraine reservation from a secure ground floor room behind the office to an exposed room on the balcony. Retired Memphis Police Department Captain Jerry Williams told the court he was responsible for forming a security detail of black homicide detectives for Dr. King's protection anytime he came to Memphis.
"We provided the best possible protection anyone could have. As long as we were there, no harm would come to Dr. King. But I told his organizers they should never make reservations for him at the Lorraine because we couldn't furnish proper security there. The Lorraine had no protection at all. To me, that was a setup from the very beginning."
On Dr. King's last visit to Memphis, Williams' superiors told him not to assemble his team and assigned him to desk duty that day.
"Took the jury 7.5 hours.
Attorney William Pepper.
"They came back and they found James Earl Ray not guilty. On the basis of just that evidence that we had at that point in 1993. Now that television trial didn't mean anything, but it did bring people forward. All of a sudden we started getting calls from this one, people with evidence. So now it started to build evidence that we didn't have before."
On the ground floor of the rooming house was a luncheonette called Jim's Grill, owned by one Lloyd Jowers. When he learned that four witnesses in Pepper's mock trial incriminated him in Dr. King's murder, he offered to tell what he knew in exchange for immunity. And he knew quite a lot, for it was in Jim's Grill that part of the plot to kill Dr. King was organized. With Jowers providing a fuller understanding of the assassination, Pepper saw another opportunity to bring the case before an independent jury. He files a civil suit of wrongful death against Jowers on behalf of the King family. One of the first witnesses to take the stand was John McFerrin. On April 4th, McFerrin was buying fruits and vegetables at a Memphis produce company owned by Frank Liberto, a man who made no secret of his underworld connections. 1 hour before Dr. King was shot, McFerrin heard Liberto shouting into his office telephone.
Look, just shoot the son of a bitch when he comes onto the balcony. Collect your money from my brother in New Orleans.
His brother, Salvatore, was a close associate of New Orleans kingpin, Carlos Marcello. McFerrin was disturbed by what he heard, but didn't know what to make of it, until he heard an hour later of the shooting of Dr. King on the balcony of the Lorraine. Reluctant to go on record against a mafia operative, McFerrin finally came forward with what he heard in a meeting with Memphis police and Fire Chief Frank Holloman, his head homicide detective, and an FBI agent, all of whom promised to check on it. They later told him he either didn't hear what he thought he did, or what he heard had nothing to do with Dr. King's murder. Thereafter, McFerrin was threatened, his store and home broken into, he was beaten up and hospitalized and shot at, until he refused to say any more about it. When Detective Ed Reddit heard he and Lieutenant Williams were ordered not to assemble their security team, he went to Fire Station Number 2, next to the rooming house and its abandoned lot, where he could at least keep an eye on the Lorraine, diagonally across the street. But an hour before the assassination, he was picked up by police intelligence officer Eli Arkin and ordered back to a meeting at police headquarters, where he was met by agents of the FBI, Secret Service, Army intelligence officers, heads of the Sheriff's Department, and the Highway Patrol. More civilian and military brass than he had ever seen assembled in one place. He is told by Police Chief Frank Holloman to take the rest of the day off. It makes no sense and he protests, but is told he is to go home, and that's an order. And Lieutenant Arkin is ordered to stay with him to make sure he stays home. While sitting outside his house in Arkin's car, they hear the police radio.
Back 10, he has been shot.
Okay, Tac 10 advising King has been shot. 604.
Later, when asked why he thought he was ordered away from the scene, Reddit replied,
I think because whoever pulled the trigger, I could identify.
Olivia Catling, who lived 200 yards from Lorraine, testified,
I heard what sounded like a gunshot coming from the direction of the hotel where I knew Dr. King was staying. So I grabbed my children, ran down the street toward the Lorraine, but I was stopped on the corner by a police barricade that said no one was allowed in or out. Just then I saw a man run from an alleyway and it connected to the rooming house. He got into a car that seemed like it was waiting for him, and they drove right past me and my kids and the police at the barricade who just let them go through. Next, I saw a fireman come running up Mulberry from the fire station. He stopped at the retaining wall and pointed up into the lot, yelling at the police that the shot came from the bushes. The police ignored him and told him to keep out of the way.
Another eyewitness didn't live long enough to testify, but his account was relayed to the jury in the sworn testimony of his co-worker, Louis Ward. His name was Paul Butler. He was known as Buddy and drove car number 58 for the Memphis Yellow Cab Company.
I was at the Lorraine right before 6 picking up a customer. As I was loading his bag, something caught my eye in them bushes on top of the wall across the street. My customer punched my arm to get me to look at the balcony where Martin had just come out of his room. Look up there, he said. There's King standing alone on the balcony. Everybody always say how hard it'll be to shoot him since he's always in a crowd. But now look at him. At that moment, the shot rang out and Dr. King fell on his back. I grabbed my microphone and told dispatch to send an ambulance to the motel. Then I saw a man come out of the bushes and jump down from the wall across the street. He run up Mulberry and got into a Memphis police car waiting on the corner. I called dispatch again and told him to tell the police that one of the units had the shooter in their car.
Buddy was taken to police headquarters to tell the story to detectives, and that was the last Louis ever saw Buddy. Buddy was pushed out of a speeding car that night and found dead on a deserted section of Arkansas Highway. All record of Buddy's employment at the Yellow Cab disappeared from company files. No report of Buddy's observations or reference to him is anywhere found in state or Memphis Police Department records. Neither obituary nor record of Buddy's death was ever found in Tennessee or neighboring states.
You want to go first?
Okay. You're back here at Membership Drive Central. It's KBOO's Spring Membership Drive, the second day of our drive, and what a beautiful day it is. You should go out and enjoy it, but first, please give us a call if you're not currently a member. You can call us at 877-500-5266 or go online at kboo.fm, or maybe you're already outside listening. We have, thanks to members, the people who support our radio station, we have the KBOO smartphone app. So you could be with your earbuds, and you can be laying in the grass down at some beautiful park in downtown Portland on this wonderful sunny day, spring day, and still listen to KBOO. Use your phone then to give us a call if you're not currently a member. While you're listening, 877-500-5266 or online at kboo.fm. And Ray, what you're supporting is what we've heard this morning, including this wonderful dramatized documentary. Audio documentary on the King assassination, which occurred about 50 years ago.
And Ken, as we were talking, you know, during the break, it's interesting to me that I don't recall when this trial story in 1999 came out. Usually, even at my advanced age, if I remember hearing something, you know, something will key your memory and you'll go, aha.
I do not remember this name here, Lloyd Jowers, but apparently he was involved in hiring a gunman from the Memphis Police Department to kill Dr. King. And this was actually documented and found credible in civil court in 1999.
And the plot included, quote, governmental agencies. So,
and mafia.
And the mafia. So it's got all the points of...
Is there a difference?
We're not even going to go there.
No, we won't go
there.
The
break's not long enough. Okay. But, you know, to come back around to the membership drive, our goal for this show is $500. And what we're promoting as a ability or your way to get involved with the station is to make a commitment of $10 a month, a continuing commitment. You can do it on a credit card or from electronic funds transfer from your account. And if you do that, two good things happen. You, first of all, will be able to get one of the limited edition KBOO 50th anniversary special packages, which includes...
50 years old, incredible. We started back in 1968.
I wish I was that young. Anyhow, the package includes the special CD, a booklet, and the KBOO lapel pin. Again, that's $120 a year. Not only will you get that commemorative package if you make that call and make that commitment today, but you also will be entered into a special drawing, and it's so appropriate for today's date, Ken.
Which is April 20th?
Yeah, 420.
Or 420. Do you happen to know, Ray, the origin of that term, 420?
I don't.
I've just heard it was the time of day where a lot of people tended to light up.
Well, that's probably one of many, isn't it?
Yeah, 4:20 p.m. or maybe 4:20 a.m., depending if you're a night person or a day person. But we do have a special package. Everybody who calls up today to become a member at whatever level will be entered in a drawing for a $300 gift certificate from Brothers. That's a medical and recreational cannabis dispensary in Portland, one of the better ones. And to do that, again, any amount. We suggest that $10 a month sustaining membership, $120 a year. As Ray said, that can come out of a checking account through electronic fund transfer, can come out of a credit card, your debit card. Just $10 a month, you get that special KBOO 50th anniversary package with the CD, the booklet, and a KBOO enamel pin you could proudly wear around town. Plus, you get entered into this drawing for $300 worth of merchandise at Brothers, the Cannabis Dispensary. You can do that by calling us now at 877-500-5266 or online at kboo.fm.
KBOO provides a diversity of content, a diversity of opinions, and we provide you the information so that you can make decisions and take action in your life. We are not the commercial media. And if you pay attention to commercial media, if you watch the news, you can flip from channel to channel. They're all saying the same thing. It's all the same message. They're all copying
it. It's amazing. The local news is basically focusing on the weather. They spend about 10 minutes on the weather and maybe a minute on news. Our poor Blazers, man. That's so sad. I'm still an optimist. I think they're going to win in seven, but I wouldn't bet on it. And also, even the big national news stations, CNN, MSNBC, they're basically all talking about Trump right now, probably deservedly so. But you're going to hear different voices, not the same old pundits that you'll hear on those stations, on cable, on your community radio station. Also, there's a lot of local things happening in town. That includes news, activism, public affairs, arts and culture. You're going to hear the voices of your community on KABU, and you're not going to hear that on the other local and national media. Certainly not. And you support all that through your KABU membership. Call us now if you're not currently a member, or if it's time to renew your membership, 877-500-5266.
And we're urging you to not only become a member, but do it in person. Take a ride down, visit us here at our station, at our address here on Southeast 8th, just below Burnside. We'd love to welcome you into the station. Certainly would like to take your membership donation, but more importantly, we'd like to tour you around the station, show you where your membership dollars go, show you your community members, your colleagues, your friends, your neighbors putting together the music, the news, the public affairs that you depend on, and also offer you the opportunity to get involved. This is community radio. We're all volunteers here. And so I'm urging you once again to take a moment and commit to supporting your community radio station here at KBOO by calling 877-500-5266, or you can go online at kboo.fm and just click on that donate button to become a member.
Or maybe you'd like to get involved, not just as a member, but to actually do your own radio, and KABU is a way of doing that. Your membership dollars actually support our training program. Ray and I both went through it. We're trainers now ourselves, which is kind of giving back for all the free education we got here at KABU. We can train you in audio production, how to use a production studio, digital editing, which I find essential to doing radio, a program where you could sit down and edit recording, an audio recording. We have training in news writing, interviewing, board opping, engineering, remotes, live remotes like the Waterfront Blues Festival, which KABU brings you, the Inner City Blues Festival. We'll be bringing you that tomorrow evening from 5 o'clock to midnight. You can be part of that. We'll train you to do it. That's where the membership dollars are going, in addition to all this great diverse programming. You can help support that by calling 877-500-526 or going online at kboo.fm and supporting programs like this.
Lloyd Jowers testified that he was told Liberto would pay him $100,000 if he would help to organize a hit they were planning on Martin Luther King. He was assured no police would be around at the crucial moment and that a fall guy was already in place. Jowers had been chosen because the back door of Jim's Grill opened onto an overgrown lot, the far end of which offered a direct line of sight across Mulberry to the Lorraine, not 200 feet distant, and its tangle of debris and bushes would offer perfect cover for a sniper team. In Jim's Grill, Jowers hosted what he called prayer meetings, attended by 24 people, including Memphis Police Inspector Lieutenant Earl Clark and the department's best marksman, Patrol Officer Frank Strausser. In this civil case, the jury heard testimony from 70 witnesses.
The trial went for 30 days.
Attorney William Pepper.
Took the jury 52 minutes. And they found for the King family against Lloyd Jowers and other unknown governmental agents and governmental conspirators. 70% responsibility was placed on the government of the United States, state of Tennessee, city of Memphis. 30% on Lloyd Jowers, because he was just a cog in that whole operation.
Walk with me,
Standing before a 250,000 people on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, about to deliver his I Have a Dream speech, Martin Luther King is introduced as the moral leader of our nation. But to those in FBI headquarters, several blocks away, he is the most dangerous man in America. The FBI has had Dr. King under surveillance since he organized the Montgomery bus boycott in 1956. In 57, his Southern Christian Leadership Council was infiltrated by the Bureau, and they opened a file on him in 58. Army intelligence had been watching Dr. King since 1947. In a briefing to President Eisenhower's cabinet during the Montgomery bus boycott, J. Edgar Hoover, director of the FBI, tells them,
"The intellect of coloreds is less than that of white children. Bathrooms must remain segregated, as coloreds aren't as conscientious about cleanliness as whites. And as for integration, it is but one step away from interracial marriage."
Hoover was also convinced the civil rights movement was an attempt of the Soviet Union to destabilize the country. Days before the March on Washington in August of 63, William Sullivan, the Bureau's head of domestic intelligence, sent Hoover a 68-page report stating the Communist Party was of no relevance to the American racial scene. Hoover sent it back to him with comments belittling his entire division. Writes David Garrow in the FBI and Martin Luther King Jr.,
"As was well known through the Bureau, agents attempting to change Hoover's mind with the facts risked being demoted, dismissed, or reassigned to some agency backwater. Agents lived in fear of Hoover's displeasure. They played it Hoover's way or found their careers terminated or stagnating in oblivion."
Former FBI agent, a 21-year veteran of the agency, Arthur Murtaugh, said,
"It was a medieval dictatorship with no influence over it, no controls, and no thought of whether something was right or wrong. If Hoover said it was right, it was right."
2 days after Dr. King delivered his dream speech, Sullivan submitted a new report calling the speech demagogic.
"The director was correct. We were completely wrong. The country is engaged in a revolution, and we must mark King as the most dangerous Negro of this nation from the standpoint of communism and national security."
In October 63, following the March on Washington, the Bureau produces an 11-page analysis entitled Communism and the Negro Movement, stating,
"Martin Luther King, an unprincipled man, was knowingly, willingly, and regularly taking guidance from communists."
Adding,
"As the Communist Party goes, so goes Martin Luther King and the Negro Movement."
In addition to the Attorney General, the White House, the Secretary of State, and Defense, the report was sent to the CIA and each branch of the military. In July of 67, Hoover instigated a spying program that went by the acronym COINTELPRO, a counterintelligence program whose focus was to be the Communist Party. But as the party at that time was said to have more undercover agents than regular members, the focus was changed to the main organization thought to be under its control, namely Black Nationalist Hate Groups, Hoover's preferred name for the civil rights movement. In the early 60s, the Ku Klux Klan, in a reign of terror, was shooting into houses, setting crosses alight in dooryards, lynching blacks, murdering civil rights workers, planting bombs, and setting black churches ablaze. In December of 61, Dr. King joined demonstrations in Albany, Georgia, protesting the winking attitude of the FBI's investigations. The Bureau responded by bringing in over 40 agents to investigate, infiltrate, and disrupt the protesters.
Head of the Albany office of the FBI, Marion Cheeks, would have been better suited as Grand Cyclops of the KKK,
said Agent Murtaugh.
He was a virulent racist who wanted no part of civil rights. Local blacks were terrified of him. He was manipulating the investigations and not even scratching the surface of the complaints. He told the new agents, "Never shake hands with black people. We don't do that down here."
King called a news conference and said the FBI is not doing its job.
"I was there. I know the FBI wasn't doing its job. Hoover wanted nothing to do with civil rights cases." King's comments didn't surprise me, but that was the beginning of the vendetta. From that time on, the concentration of effort against King was greater than any other single investigation I saw at the Bureau. And I saw a lot of them in 20 years. He was codenamed Zorro, and there was a crew of people known as the Get King Squad who did almost nothing for a period of 7 or 8 years except to try to destroy him.
Historian Howard Zinn authored a report stating blacks in Albany, Georgia, had no faith in local FBI agents who had yet to make a single arrest on behalf of black citizens against white segregationists. When King was asked to comment, he agreed, saying FBI agents who are themselves segregationists were not fairly investigating civil rights violations. Hoover informs his second-in-command at the Bureau, Clyde Tolson, that black bag jobs, as they were known, shall be expanded to include illegal surveillance, intimidation, audits, forging documents, planting evidence, feeding fictitious stories to the media to convince the public the civil rights movement was a tentacle of the Soviet Union, telling him,
"If it leads to arrests and keeps the country safe, what of it?"
Said Arthur Murtaugh,
"The Bureau never investigated right-wing extremist groups with anywhere near the intensity it leveled against left-wing and black activist organizations. Still, agents were slow to realize the Get King campaign was driven by Hoover's personal hatred of King. It was the opinion of the Bureau that the civil rights movement was a communist conspiracy, and that explained the Bureau's efforts to defeat it. But as Hoover changed the Bureau's focus from the more volatile elements of the movement, Stokely Carmichael, H. Rap Brown, Huey Newton, into an all-out campaign to neutralize King, myself and others within the Bureau began to view it differently. It was an organized vendetta. They were going to get King one way or the other."
Martin first spoke out against the Vietnam War in 1965, but it brought harsh criticism from black leaders who wanted him to limit his focus to civil rights, and he fell silent on the war for more than a year. But deeply disturbed by an article by William Pepper while a journalist in Vietnam, with photographs of Vietnamese children burned by napalm, Martin finally laid out his thoughts on the war on April 4, 1967, at New York's Riverside Church, when he said in part,
"And I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. We are on the side of the wealthy and the secure while we create a hell for the poor. The image of America will never again be the image of revolution, freedom, and democracy, but the image of violence and militarism. This is the role our nation has taken by refusing to give up the privileges and the pleasures that come from the immense profits of overseas investments. When machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people, the giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death."
Martin finally giving opposition to the war his full voice was one of the happiest moments of his life,
said Coretta Scott King.
"I thought it was one of the finest and most prophetic speeches of his life. He was the first major voice in America to say it plainly. The United States is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today."
But virtually every major news outlet in the country and much of the black press rail against him. They call him the mouthpiece of Hanoi. The Army and FBI raised Dr. King's status to threat to national security. During his last year, Martin was formulating his plan for the Poor People's Campaign, an open call for the nation's poor to convene on the National Mall. And after the second Memphis march, scheduled for April 5th, Martin planned to go to impoverished Quitman County, Mississippi, to lead that arm of the march to the Capitol at the head of a mule train.
The government was badly shaken by all of this, badly shaken.
Attorney William Pepper.
They had to make sure he didn't get to Washington. That's really what it came down to.
He advocated building a city, a tent city in the shadow of the Washington Memorial, and staying there.
And every day, people from all over the country going and visiting their congressmen and their senators and saying to them, you must put back into the budget all these funds that have been removed because of the war. And I believe, frankly, that was the major reason they killed him. Not the war. The war was important. But it was, in my view, the serious challenge of the March on Washington and the encampment in Washington is why they killed him. Because they saw that as the major threat to the structure. 100 cities in the United States had burned that year. They were convinced Martin King would lose control of his 500,000 people when they didn't get the largesse back from the Congress, and that the more radical elements would take over and they would have a revolution they couldn't put down. And I think without doubt that made it necessary for them to kill him.
Where else but KBOO would you get these kinds of stories? You would have to search high and low to find this kind of information, these kind of stories, and really look at history. This is KBOO's spring membership drive. We're urging listeners to give a call and make a commitment. Become a sustaining member. We're looking for $10 a month for, or $120 a year, charge to your credit card, or to your electronic fund transfer from your checking account. And that will get you the KBOO 50th Anniversary Special Package, which includes a CD, a booklet, and an enamel lapel pin. So take this opportunity. Give us a call, 877-500-5266, or online at KBOO-FM. And also get in line for a special drawing based on today's date.
Yeah, and that CD, Ray, has a selected programming from our incredible KBOO archive going back 50 years. And that booklet is from the current exhibit at the Oregon Historical Society on 50 years of KBOO. And then, of course, that collector's enamel pin, which you wear around town. That's for $10 a month, $120 a year. Just give us a call at 877-500-5266 or go online at kboo.fm. And you could also be entered today. For any membership amount, you'll be entered into a drawing. And what is today, Ray?
April 20th or 420?
420, so appropriately enough. This is the raffle.
Yes, right. So become a member now and be entered into today's drawing for a $300 gift certificate from Brothers, a medical and recreational cannabis dispensary. So give us a call, 877-500-5266 now, or go online to kboo.fm and click on donate to become a member.
Lenny Curtis was for many years a custodian in the Memphis Police Department's firing range. In a sworn deposition taken by William Pepper in 2003, Curtis said Officer Frank Strausser had been boasting for months that someone was going to shoot Dr. King. And for 2 days prior to the murder, he had been in the shooting range firing a military-grade rifle that had recently come to the station. The afternoon of the murder, Mayor Henry Loeb, Police Chief Holloman, and numerous policemen went into a meeting with Strausser and Lieutenant Earl Clark, after which Strausser left with the bundle that appeared to contain the rifle he had been firing.
Martin was killed by a Memphis police officer who was paid a sum of money to do it.
But, says Pepper,
he was the mechanic. That's all he was.
In political assassinations, whose organizers concealed themselves within multiple rings of deniability, it is of little worth, says Pepper, knowing who actually pulled the trigger. The greater value lies in knowing who paid him, who organized him to do it. And when Rod Atkins stepped forward with firsthand accounts of the role he and his family played in the murder, the innermost rings of the plot finally cracked.
The colonel, there was a colonel, John Downey, coordinated the whole operation from the 902nd Military Intelligence Group in the bowels of the Pentagon.
William Pepper.
John Downey was CIA. He had a military cover, but he was CIA. He had the links to the mob. He knew everything. Maybe the only person who ever knew all aspects of this was Colonel Downey. And he had no qualms about organizing that effort because he believed that Martin King was a danger to the security of the United States. The Assistant Chief of Staff Intelligence, William Yarborough, was the man who gave him the orders to organize the assassination.
And also in the loop, says Pepper.
Lyndon Johnson had to, in general terms anyway, approve the scenario for the assassination of Martin King. He wouldn't have to know the details and get involved with that, but he would have to know about it.
But at the source of it all...
This was a J. Edgar Hoover operation. Everything flowed from Hoover. Hoover had this good relationship, obviously, with organized crime and Marcello and the Dixie Mafia, so he was able to use that relationship to carry it out.
Hoover had identified Dr. King back in the 50s, and he was focused on King as an enemy that he, Hoover, thought had to be gotten rid of. Hoover's number two, who was also his lover, Clyde Tolson, was the man Hoover sent around the country with bags of money to pay for some of the worst types of activity you can imagine. Clyde Tolson was very much involved with the people on the ground who carried out the assassination of Martin King. I have photographic evidence now. I have written evidence now. There's no question about that, that Tolson was a major planner in this whole operation.
In his sworn deposition taken by Pepper in accordance with the Tennessee Rules of Civil Procedure, Ron Adkins detailed the close ties between the Ku Klux Klan, the Masons, and the Dixie Mafia. Adkins' father, Russell Sr., had long been a member of all three. And when still a boy, his father would take him to lynchings and meetings where he frequently saw Mayor Loeb, mobsters Frank Liberto and Carlos Marcello, and Clyde Tolson. Marcello and Tolson were regular visitors to the Adkins family, and from an early age, Ron was told to call Tolson Uncle Clyde. Ron produced photographs of Tolson and the family together on numerous occasions, saying when Hoover wanted things handled in the Memphis area, he would send Tolson down to see his father with instructions and satchels of cash. On one visit in late 66, Tolson arrived with $25,000 and instructions that his father deliver the cash to the warden of the Missouri State Penitentiary, Harold Swenson. Ron rode with his father and was in the warden's office when the money was exchanged. Unbeknownst to Ray, even unto his death, Hoover had asked Swenson to identify a convict who, if allowed to escape, could be easily handled. Ray, serving a sentence for armed robbery, was chosen, and on April 23, 1967, his way made clear. He escaped the penitentiary and was thereafter controlled by undercover agents. In Memphis, Hoover kept a close working relationship with Police Chief Frank Holloman, who for 10 years was inspector in charge of Hoover's Washington office. Holloman headed up the Atlanta office that mounted the vendetta against King, and was in charge of the Memphis office when issues of the sanitation worker strike were festering. In January of 65, Hoover sent William Sullivan to a meeting with Holloman at the Atlanta Bureau to discuss a plan to assassinate King, whose codename was Zorro. Agent Arthur Murtaugh recalls one agent came out of the meeting exclaiming,
"We're going to get Zorro! We're really going to get him!"
And 2 months later, an Army sniper very nearly killed Dr. King during the Voting Rights March from Selma to Montgomery. Said Holloman,
"I have nothing to apologize for anything we did when I was at the Bureau. We did what we had to do. J. Edgar Hoover was a friend of mine, and I saw nothing he did that was wrong."
In his deposition, Ron Adkins said the Memphis plot on their end was planned in the Burr Claire Baptist Church, the Masonic Temple, and at the Adkins family home with his father, his mother, and his older brother, Russell Jr. King is scheduled to address an audience at the Bishop Charles Mason Church that evening as tornadoes sweep across the area. Lightning flashes, thunder rolls, and civil defense sirens wail through the city. Rapturous applause greets him as he comes in out of the driving rain. He speaks for 2 hours without notes, just as the storm is cresting. It is his last public address.
And some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out. What would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers? Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
In a pre-dawn briefing, a U.S. Army Special Forces sniper team is shown target acquisition photos, two men, and the layout of a motel. Their assignment, Memphis. Their target, Martin Luther King and Andrew Young. Their mission, when ordered, shoot to kill. One team is placed on the roof of the 8-story Illinois Central Railroad building southwest of the Lorraine, the other atop the Taylor Paper Company water tower to the west. What they are not told is that they will be called upon only if the police team concealed in the brush behind the rooming house miss.
Walk with me, Lord. Walk with me.
That evening, police informant Billy Kyles is hosting a barbecue for Martin and his party, and he is to have him out of his room at 6. Moments before, two men in the courtyard of the Lorraine call up for Dr. King. When he comes out, he goes to the railing and speaks with them, Jesse Jackson and Ben Branch. Martin suspected Jackson as an FBI informant, and tempers have flared between them. To make amends, Martin invites Jesse to join them for dinner. Jesse introduces him to Branch, a musician who will play at a meeting that evening. Martin tells Branch, "Be sure to play Precious Lord, Take My Hand, and play it like you've never played it before, real pretty."
Lead me on. Let me stand.
The Army snipers center their scopes on Martin and Andrew Young. With fingers on their triggers, they await the order to fire. Across Mulberry, the police team fixes theirs on Martin. Just past 6, Strausser fires, and Martin falls.
I am one. Through the storm.
The bullet has hit his jaw, nicked his carotid artery, and come to rest beneath his shoulder blade. He is critically wounded, bleeding heavily, but very much alive. As Lloyd Jowers told ABC's Primetime Live and testified under oath, when the shot is fired, he is crouched in the brush, to the side and just behind Lieutenant Earl Clark and Patrolman Frank Strausser. Clark is seen by numerous witnesses jumping down from the retaining wall and heading up Mulberry to the corner where he gets into a patrol car that speeds from the scene. Strausser passes the rifle to Jowers and flees in the other direction. Jowers runs through the lot into the back door of Jim's Grill, where he is seen by waitress Betty Spates rushing into the kitchen with a smoking rifle, in her words, looking white as a sheet. Within minutes, bulletins are sounding across the country.
Police describe a young, well-dressed, medium-built white male driving a white Mustang, shot at and wounded possibly.
In his deposition, Rod Atkins recounted the planning sessions where family friend Dr. Breen Bland, head of surgery at St. Joseph's Hospital, had stressed the importance of getting Dr. King to him if the assassins didn't kill him. A fire department ambulance is first on the scene and takes Martin to the emergency department at St. Joseph's, where there is already assembled a crowd of police, Army intelligence officers, and FBI agents. Emergency staff perform a tracheotomy and insert a breathing tube in advance of rushing Martin to surgery. According to the sworn deposition of Jonathan Shelby, taken by William Pepper, his mother, surgical aide Lula Mae Shelby, is hurrying surgical tools into the emergency room when Dr. Bland enters with two men in suits and begins shouting,
"Stop working on this nigger and just let him die. All of you, get out of here, right now."
Lula Mae Shelby is dumbstruck, but Bland keeps shouting,
"Everybody out! Out! Out!"
Shelby is the last staff person to leave the room. When nearly to the door, she hears three men gathering phlegm and spitting. In disbelief, she turns to see they have removed the breathing tube and Dr. Bland is pressing a pillow over the face of Dr. King.
Guard my feet. Hold my hand.
At 7 p.m., Dr. King is pronounced dead. Police Chief Frank Holloman issues a statement.
I and all the citizens of Memphis regret the murder of Dr. King, and all resources at our and the state's command will be used to apprehend the person or persons responsible.
No evidence of conspiracy, says Hoover, and the hunt is underway for the lone gunman.
Me home.
FBI agent Arthur Murtaugh.
It was between 6 and 7. I was standing at the sign-out desk with another agent, and the news came over the radio that Dr. King had been shot and killed in Memphis. This agent turned to me and hit his fist together like that and said something to the effect, "By God, we finally got him."
Love thy neighbor.
When Murtaugh saw his supervisor, the man leaped into the air yelling,
"They got Zorro! They got the son of a bitch!"
Hoover, too, rejoiced and did as he did upon being notified of John and 2 months later, Robert Kennedy's assassination. He celebrated with a day at the races, going to Baltimore's Pimlico racetrack with Clyde Tolson, where he would often boast the track paid his winnings and covered his losses.
He did not hide. It's hard to think this great man.
You have been listening to Assignment Memphis. For a full list of credits and sources, please visit our website, assignmentmemphis.com.
Well, the murders never cease. Are they men or are they beasts?
That was Radio Zine.